Welcome to another episode of Elaine's Literary Salon podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. My wife, Cynthia, and I own Elaine's Literary Salon and Restaurant, which has become the literary hub for the Washington, D.C. area. I'm excited today. We're doing our 180th interview, and I have an actor with us who's incredibly prolific. So prolific, it took me a long time to cut down his bio. Gregory Jabara is an American actor and singer known for his work on Broadway, television, and in films. He's appeared in projects across the stage, screen, and voice work with over 60 acting credits. Jabara won the 2009 Tony Outer Critics Circle and Drama Desk Awards for Best Featured Actor in a Musical, originating the role of Jackie Elliott in the Broadway production of Billy Elliot. He also starred on Broadway as Billy Flynn in the Tony Award-winning revival of Chicago. Jabara received the Backstage West Garland 2000 Award for his performance in West Coast premiere of Precious Sons, and he has more than a dozen other stage credits. His recurring television roles include Blue Bloods, where he played NYPD Deputy Commissioner of Public Information Garrett Moore over more than 250 episodes. He was a series regular on Grounded for Life, Adventures in Odyssey, and The Other Half. His notable guest appearances include Newhart, The Drew Carey Show, Frasier, Malcolm in the Middle, Friends, The West Wing, Family Guy, American Dad, Law and Order, and on. Seriously, a lot of credits here. His dozens of film roles include Oppenheimer, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and The Out-of-Towners, Broken City, and Epic Movie. He's the voice of the animatronic radio newscaster in Epcot Center's Spaceship Earth. His Disney animated feature credits include Tangled, Enchanted, Toy Story, and others. He appeared as Kenny in the Carnegie Hall concert version of The Very Warm for May with John Lovitz. Jabara's recordings include the Broadway cast recordings of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Victor Victoria and Damn Yankees, Peter Pan, and many more. He was a narrator for Ripley's Believe It or Not on TBS, and his voice is featured on the Best of Ripley's DVD release. Jabara resides with his wife, Julie, and their son, Zachary and Aiden, in Los Angeles. He's here to talk about his directorial debut with Original Sound. Greg, welcome to Elaine's Literary Podcast, and if I missed anything major, let me know, because honestly, it's a huge CV.
Do you want to go take a break? That was like the longest, most involved info I've ever heard. That was 40 years for sure, right there.
You know what? I usually keep those fairly short, you know, or introducing people to give an idea, but you're just so prolific, and you're in, like, you know, it's voice acting and stage and the big screen and television, and like, it doesn't do you justice to not hit like all those major categories. I mean, you're in some of the most like iconic shows in television history, for example.
Well, I appreciate your detail and including them all. You kind of took me down memory lane there too, a little bit. I was going, oh yeah, that's right, I did do that.
So when you're that busy, and I'm sort of in the same boat in some ways. When you hear things, do you kind of forget? Do you really forget that you did things like because you're just moving so fast all the time, but you're always looking at the next project or what's in front of you?
Absolutely, but I'm also thinking now that I'm 64 that maybe I just don't remember things anymore. I think that is a reality for me. So I write everything down, but I find myself more often than not, as I get older, surprised by things that I go, oh, right. Oh, we did. And mostly it's, especially with doing Broadway shows, all the people that I've invited who come to New York and then see a show that I'm in and then have this great memory of us spending time backstage after. And, you know, I did that for 15, 25 years. And everybody goes, yeah, we met. Remember, we came backstage and we did this whole thing. And I go, I don't specifically remember because I probably did that every single night. But I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to forget all the wonderful encounters I've had as a byproduct of the work that I get to do.
You know, it's interesting. We do mostly authors here, but a lot of them are also actors, you know, so we have people who are in different various arts. You know, it seems like the creative mind can work in a lot of different mediums. When what I'm really interested in is like the storytelling as an actor on the stage or on TV and when people are writing it, it's so similar in a lot of ways. I'm curious, like, let's kind of go back to the beginning with you. When did you first get captivated by story? When did you know that this was something you wanted to do?
Yeah, I don't know that my initial bug for being up on stage came from an awareness of the power of storytelling as much as it was the power of being noticed. In third grade, I was an altar boy at, you know, growing up Catholic. And went to a public school and someone had said on a Monday, "Hey man, I saw you up on stage in your red dress with the white frilly stuff." And I said, "You did?" And he goes, "Yeah, man, that must be cool." And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then as an altar boy, the morning masses, we do 6:30 a.m. masses throughout the week. And the adults who normally read from scripture on the weekends aren't getting up for those 6:30 masses. So we young altar boys are getting cold reading, practical experience, sharing biblical names at 6:30 in the morning with not enough breakfast, clearly, or caffeine at that age. So I really had a facility for public speaking. And then it probably wasn't till maybe I had the first audience when I was in junior high and doing theater, and that I realized, oh, this is great. This is it truly is an interactive experience. Yes, it is storytelling, which I think is vital to humanity. I mean, it's been going on since cave painting, right? But the shared experience is definitely one of the things that happens in the moment as a stage actor that doesn't happen when you're working on screen in front of a camera. I can remember what film, I think it was, might have been Crocodile Dundee 2, maybe The House on Carroll Street. I went to the theater to go watch it, to go see whether my very small part had an effect, whether it was considered comedic, because I needed to hear the audience to inform me whether I was doing my job right. You know, when you're on a set, everybody's got to be dead quiet. And even though people are snickering, you hope, if it's funny or being moved, if you're doing emotional work, the payoff, which is the audience informing you that you're successful in your storytelling, it doesn't happen in the same way immediately in TV or film like it does when you're on stage 8 times a week, which is why I prefer the storytelling aspect, because as a storyteller, I feel more actively involved live on stage 8 times a week than I do in front of a camera when you do your work and then someone else decides what parts of it they're going to use.
Wow, there's so much good stuff there. I want to unpack it just a little bit. Like, if you can remember back, like, I've interviewed several comedians, and that's all about, you know, getting the feedback from the audience, right, and knowing what works and what doesn't. And a lot of times it's people who have always kind of felt like outside of society a little bit, you know, and so they're looking at it and able to criticize or able to make fun of and to be able to do it almost as like an objective observer. When you were younger and you were getting this moment, you're on stage, people are recognizing you, you're getting that kind of interaction. What do you think, like, psychologically is going on there? Like, what is it? Is it a way for you just to, like, to have reassurance that you're alive, that you're there, that you're doing something? Or is it just the be able to get credit or to be able to, you know, so you know you're doing something important? Like, do you ever know what that is as you're so experienced at this point?
Yeah. Okay. So in first grade, our class sang Frosty the Snowman for the Christmas concert, and somebody from my class had to be selected to play Frosty. And Mrs. McCullough said, "Oh, it'll be Greg, you're going to do it," which meant I didn't sing like the rest of my class who stood on the risers and sang the song. I got wrapped in tissue paper, had charcoal colored eyes and a, you know, top hat. And all I had to do was walk back and forth in front of the risers while the entire rest of the class sang. And I was terrified because it was the first time, I think, ever I was singled out. It was, you know, singing with a group, there's safety, right? There's not a spotlight on you. And it wasn't that all I had to do was walk, you know, from one side of the stage to the other. But I was terrified. But when it was over, there was all this support and going, you know, because I was, what, 5 or 6. And, you know, everybody's going, "Greg, you did such a great job." And it was like, oh, because I was terrified. You know, I didn't share that. But I literally, it was fear like I'd never known, because it was an unknown experience. But once I got through the other end and all this adulation and recognition for a job well done, I think I carry that sort of need. Because, you know, actors, if we could walk around with it, like right now, I'm so enjoying, I can see you, but I also like watching my face while I'm talking as we're doing this podcast. So, you know, we actors are very aware of ourselves, and the opportunity to, you know, be seen and commended for whatever it is. But it really is, as an actor, it does, nobody wants to be told they did a lousy job. So it
reminds me of like almost like a drug interaction, right? Like you're getting these endorphin hits from the adulation. And that is physiologically addictive, right? Like for, you know, the drug addict, even before the drugs become physically addictive, it's psychologically addictive. Do you think a similar, I mean, it seems very similar, right? Because you're getting that same dopamine hit.
Yeah. And let's say you do, you work on a TV show or even just, but the moment that gig's over, and that happens all the time, gigs end, then you're suddenly left with yourself again. And yeah, I think you go into withdrawal, both on an addictive level and also psychologically, because your purpose is when you are actively doing the thing that identifies you as an artist. And when you're not doing that, who are you? And you're not getting the dopamine hit and you're not getting a paycheck. There are a lot of things that make unemployment kind of tough.
So acting has to be one of the hardest professions to break out in. Like it's really difficult for writers. You know, there's like about last year, 4 million books were published, but 3.5 million were self-published, right? So to get out with actually traditionally published books, it's incredibly difficult. Agents take something like 1 out of every 4,000 queries, but it sounds much worse for actors to me because you don't have 4 million movies coming out, right? There's probably what, a couple hundred movies that come out a year. I don't know how many TV shows, but it's a smaller pool of opportunities. So absolutely. Like, how difficult was this for you to get into this and find some success?
So from day one, from junior high, from all the way through grade school, and I went to the Wayne Westland Public Schools in suburban Detroit, and it was at a time when families were going, yeah, we'll pay taxes so we have a babysitter because we're all working. It's a working class community. You know, the superintendent, the arts were important. So there was an opportunity to learn to do anything I wanted growing up. And let's see, where was I going with that? What was your question? It was
because the odds of breaking out, you know, the starving actor, the starving artist is such a trope. Like how do you think you got, was it just perseverance and hard work?
So I'm marching band president. I'm in student government. I'm president every other year because I alternate with my buddy. We are in marching band. We do orchestra, choir, everything. I'm cast in leads in all the shows. Comes time for college, I'm going to be a theater major at the University of Michigan. And the parents go, oh no. And I go, wait, this is like, I'm a performer. This is what you, yeah. But we don't know anybody who makes a living, and we don't want you coming back to the house after you have your bachelor of fine arts degree that's not going to put food on the table. And I'm going, but wait, you know, because, and it was true. Maybe you're an educator in the arts, but did you make a living as an artist? A year at Michigan as a communications major with a minor in physics, because I love blowing things up in high school. I took just a year to understand that those people in my physics 101 class were doing in their heads what it took me hours every night to study to do. And I was getting cast in all the non-department shows. And at the end of the first year, I, without my parents' permission, changed my major and became a theater major, got cut off financially. But, it, you know, then it was $1,400 a year to go to University of Michigan as an in-state student. It was ridiculous, but that was still a hit in 1979 for me. So, you know, student loans, but it would take at work jobs. And then, but I was happy and I went after it. But like everybody who, and while I was at Michigan, my mentors there said, you should probably go to a more rigorous training program. We had just founded the musical theater program at Michigan. I co-founded a dance company there. They were going, yeah, we see bigger things for you. You should audition for one of the league schools, Juilliard, Yale, NYU, Southern Methodist. There's like 12 of them in the league. I met with, it was the Michigan Mafia. 64. But I had a lot of really helped people that helped me and saw my potential. And then I got into Juilliard. I auditioned and got into Juilliard. It was a series of events, but it was me always going after more and better. And but I had my entire life up until that point was nothing but confirmation and affirmation that this is what you do. You have a gift for it. This is where you belong. Here's more opportunity. Here's more opportunity. So that when I graduated from Juilliard and became a working actor, people go, man, how did you get here? And I go, well, it's always been my trajectory, and it's always been something I've gone after. It's not like I was, you know, sitting around and going, oh, I think acting would be fun, you know? And I go, just know you're going to be competing for jobs with people who have spent their entire formative years working toward this moment to finally go into the industry, and you're going to be competing with them. So know that, and there are people who just, you know, are waiting at table and the right producer's there and says, hey, I want to make you a star. And those things do happen. But how actors now start in the business, because the industry's shrinking, the opportunities are becoming fewer and fewer. I'm grateful that I'm a year away from retirement, and that I'm vested in three unions from 40 years of work. So I know that I won't be destitute, but I'm amazed at the artists who now, you know, come from all over middle America and go, I'm going to go and find my fortune in New York or LA or Chicago or whatever. That's an amount of courage that I didn't have, because I had the safety net of the Juilliard School taking me to New York to introduce me to that hub of industry. But the people who don't have something like that and just say, I'm going to go make it happen, I'm in awe. And I think it's even harder anymore, because that sort of rule, yeah, you go to the right school and then you're going to have a job and then you're going to get picked up and you'll work regionally in theaters and you'll always have but all those opportunities are going away. So people that are successful, young artists and old, who find their way now starting out, I go like this, because I wouldn't know how to begin that. It seems like too daunting a task.
I mean, the parallels with the literary world are really striking, because it's the same thing. It was in some ways so much easier to find a path to success, to break out along, you know, 40 years ago. And now there's just so much noise out there. It's become incredibly hard for people. There isn't that one pathway like you're talking about.
Right.
You did mention I had the safety net of Juilliard, but you had that later. Like, you took this bold step, right, where you were cut off financially and you said, this is what I'm going to do. And you went all in, basically. Do you think, in my head, I'm thinking it's sort of like the discovering the new world and burning your ship so your men have no choice but to survive, right? Like, was there the financial stress and really just a psychological commitment to it? Was the desperation of that something that you think attributed to your success?
Yes. And I think it ultimately was part of my parents' learning lesson for me, that they wanted me to, you know, they didn't want me to fall into stuff that came easy. They really wanted me to push and go after. And I think in hindsight, that's what they were doing, because I did have a habit of, you know, a short attention span with things, and they were worried for me. And this was fortunately a career path that really spoke to me, and I was able to exploit with my passion.
Do you consider it like a calling? Like, when I counsel authors, I talk to hundreds of authors every year, and there's a stark difference between the people who are like, I'm a storyteller, this is what I'm going to do, and I don't care if I don't ever make it, but this is what I'm doing because I want to, I'm meant to do this. Is that what you felt?
Absolutely. It's the only thing I wake up every morning excited to do, and the possibility of it, that being an actor, a storyteller. I could, you know, that loft bed, my office is now my boy's old bedroom. That loft bed was something I built, just like every single wall in this 1923 house that we bought, and then we stripped it, and I did all the renovation with my cousin Dan Conroy. So I could work as a carpenter or a home builder, but it's not, and I enjoy it, especially doing it for myself, but I'm slow because I'm obsessive with doing it right. But it's not the same calling that it is to still be an actor. And I'm just grateful that suddenly, as this my big gig, you know, 15 seasons of Blue Bloods came to an end, that I was just handed this opportunity to now direct a feature film, which was something I never saw coming.
Oh my God. Yeah. I really want to get into that and the difference. You know, when you talk about your obsessive, this compulsion to do things right, how does that translate into your process when you're acting? Like, because the another parallel between the authors I interview, right, and actors are you're inside someone's head, you're seeing through their eyes, right? You're becoming that person. Can you just tell us a little bit about your process in that when you're acting?
You know, here's a good example. When I was taking over for Jimmy Naughton in Chicago, the Broadway revival, they only gave me 2 weeks to rehearse my track and then be thrown on stage with the entire original revival cast, including B.B. Newirth and, I mean, the whole Megilla. But what I realized was what a luxury it is to discover the story with an entire cast, the writing team, the creative team for months. Like Billy Elliot, which was my last Broadway job, we rehearsed that for over 3 months before we ever put it in front of a live audience. And the luxury and the security of that journey, of being able to fail, of being up to discover, to try things and throw them out, all of those things that happen in theater are pretty spectacular, and that you get to finally when, you know, when you close into opening night, everybody agrees, okay, this is the show we're going to do. And then that's the show you do 8 times a week. And there, I don't have an appetite for artists who get bored on stage and then start joking around and or trying to make their castmates laugh on stage. I think that is theft. I think an audience member that comes and is paying a ridiculous amount of money to see your best show, they're not paying to see that you don't have the attention span to have integrity as an artist. So I think that's really important. And I find a lot of actors who don't come from the theater originally and find themselves starring in a Broadway show, they go, oh man, this is boring. You know, they're used to the TV and film world, which is like today I just had to self-tape for a new film that shoots in June. And all you get is the sides from the scene and the script. And then as the actor, my job is to come up with the most impressive choices for this character and put them on tape in a day and a half, and create all the possibilities in just a day and a half, just to have the opportunity to be cast that thing. And then you'll have time to find whatever your acting scene partners have to give you. But that's very different than when you have the 3-month audition process to develop a show. And when you're shooting a film or on Blue Bloods, we get a script. We didn't get it. Often we don't have the sides, which are the pages for a particular scene, till that morning. We show up and they go, oh, here's all new sides here for your 5-page scene. And what I developed was this ability to memorize 5 pages of dialogue in 45 minutes. And we would rehearse the scene, you know, we'd all read it together in the space that we're going to shoot. And then we put it on its feet and we all agree, these are the words that we're going to use. And that was honored to a T with Tom Selleck. He had no appetite for ad-libbing or, you know, frumping around. It's like, this is the script. The play is the thing. We agree that these are the words that do the story that we want to tell. And then we honor them. And that's a part of something that I really appreciate about Tom Selleck and working with him. And I feel the same way. I've always had that ethic. But then we go away while they light the scene. And in 45 minutes while I'm putting on my costume, I'm off book and ready to start filming that scene. Now, granted, we're going to shoot all of Tom Selleck's close-ups first. So I have the rehearsal of working with the camera over my shoulder on him to fine tune my nuances. Right. But, it's a whole other craft working as an actor on camera than it is when you're working as an actor on stage.
Yeah, they sound so different. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff in what you just said. I love it. When going back to the stage, when you have like 3 months to develop a character and you're working behind the scenes and you're not doing that in front of the live audience, I'm curious when you're doing like, I guess, table reads and you're working with the director and you're working with your fellow actors, How different is it with their reactions to what you're doing than like because they're professionals? Is it a different reaction to something that you would get from like audience members? Like when you're changing your character based on these table reads, how much does that relate to the actual experience in front of an audience full of people who aren't professionals?
I would say here's the thing. It happens first table read for a sitcom. It happens first table read for a Broadway show, if they're comedies, right? Working on Grounded for Life, we'd sit down, we read the script for the first time. The entire writing team is laughing at all the jokes because they're trying to show the producers and the director that this is good material, right? And encourage their actors to go ahead. And I became aware of that dynamic. Yes, it's good writing and we all chuckle, but it's like, oh, they're laughing a little hard at their own work. Oh, I see what they're doing. They're protecting their part of the show, right? When you do a table read with a Broadway show, maybe it's a cast of 40 people with Billy Elliot, or it's a cast of 20 people. Everybody's so excited to have a job. Everybody's so thrilled to be there. You have the people that are reading and then all the creative who are sitting around, and it's a celebration more of, hey, look how lucky we are that we get to start this journey together. So there's joy and positive energy underneath. So there's a lot of generous laughter and or emotion that takes place simply because of the communal experience that we're about to launch into. I don't know that I've ever been in a table read here's a good story though. So the Patriot, the film The Patriot, stars Mel Gibson, the late great, he played the Joker, Australian actor.
I know who you're talking about. You remember?
Mel Gibson is also producing this film, and he doesn't want to read his part for the first table read, but this cast for this feature film. So casting director April Webster calls me and goes, "Hey, Greg, would you come in and read Mel Gibson's part for the table read for this film? He doesn't want to read. He just wants to listen." And I went, "Yeah, I'll come and read for, you know," and whoever the writer directors that they're like the infamous, you know, Independence Day creative team. It's like, yeah. And it's a Sony picture. Oh, yeah. So I'm there between, he played, man, at 64, names just go, but it's young Australian actor who played Joker. He's playing Mel's character's son, and the villain is a soldier played by, and he's the bad guy in Harry Potter with the long white hair. That actor,
it's a great movie.
Yeah. The Patriot we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yep. So we do the read. No, before we do the read, I'm sitting between the two of them because that's where Mel's character sits in this table read. And they're just real human beings sitting there going, "Man, you are so lucky." They're talking to me. "You are so lucky because you can't get fired after today's table read." He goes, they're going, we could mess this up. And then they could all go, "Oh, we made a mistake. Let's let them go. Let's hire somebody else." And I'm thinking, wow, you guys are all already established, accomplished actors. But the fragility of that moment in that situation for a big studio picture, it's like, oh, yes, I am lucky that I'm not in this cast. And it was fun to do, but it also made me love those two actors whose names escape me. But welcome to my life now.
So, I mean, is that something that's motivating in keeping help? Like you mentioned before, on stage, actors having to do the same thing, but like eight times a week or whatever. That does seem like it'd be hard to keep your energy up. But I feel your enthusiasm when you talk about it. Is it the gratitude that you have because you're in that spot? Or like what kept your enthusiasm up?
So doing eight shows a week on a Broadway show, you know that every night 1,400 new people are seeing it for the first time. And you want them to have the best possible experience. And you want them to also go, "Oh, that Greg Chabarro, he's a good actor." So you don't ever want to fail on any level, even if it's like you go up on a line or you miss an entrance or, you know, it's just, but it's not fear-based. It is professional habit. And I don't worry. Once the show's up and running, it's like it's second nature. You can be standing in the wings, making an absolutely inappropriate joke to somebody, and then just step on stage and suddenly you're in the world that is in front of the audience. And that's what's great about that.
It was the motivation on stage, but then we were talking about the fear and like a table read when you're doing like a big production.
Right. And so it's never
also motivate.
I don't like fear. Fear makes no sense to me. I think enthusiasm, right? There was a really interesting story about fear. And this is my opinion about something I observed. Victor Victoria starring Julie Andrews, Blake Edwards directing. And we're in rehearsals and we're all, you know, it's a family and we're all, but what I observed in the amazing, beautiful, radiant Julie Andrews was Blake asked her to do something that was a little kooky and crazy just to try it. And she wouldn't because she, from what I've learned in my years, that she was afraid of looking foolish, like, and of it failing or her not being able to accomplish what it was he was asking of her. And so there was maybe a 10-15 minute conversation that they had privately that, and then she ended up not doing it. And I thought, oh, that's interesting that the environment where Julie Andrews of all people might be concerned about how she's perceived and or doesn't want to fail. And that's just my judgment of that moment. I don't know that to be true, but on future Broadway jobs, I've worked with actors who cannot take a note, who the director says, hey, we're in rehearsals. We're not even, you know, early days rehearsals. I want you to try it like this. And the actor goes, no, you know what? I don't think that's right. I think if and you spend 20 minutes having a debate about it instead of the director, who's an Academy Award nominated, Tony Award winning director, is saying, I'd like you to try something. Then you just go, yeah, let's try it. Because either it's going to be genius and we're all going to see it and know it, or we're all going to see and know, oh no, that's a bad idea. And we move on. And it happens in a minute instead of wasting 20 to 30 minutes having an argument or debate about it. And that process, I think, is a product of the arguing, is a product of fear. And I feel for the people that live in that space. One of the things that I really looked for when I was when I directed this feature film was to be the top of the pyramid and be the guy who said, best idea wins. So, you know, I don't want anyone ever going to sleep thinking, oh, I wish I told them about this thing. It would have been better. I want to hear about it because I'm going to get the credit for it. But I want you to feel good about the work that you're doing in your particular department, whether you're an actor, whether you're the costume designer, the production designer. I want everyone to feel empowered and heard and safe and willing to fail. And that's something that I think breeds greater creativity than walking through life afraid that it's all going to go away. But I'm saying sometimes, you know, there's still that imposter syndrome, right? Where you just go, I'm that kid who poops in diapers from Westland, Michigan. And look at all this incredible stuff I get to do. I'm just a regular guy, but I get to do really cool stuff. One day it's all going to go away. Someone's going to go, no, you don't belong here. But it hasn't happened yet.
So I've interviewed New York Times bestselling authors who've had, you know, 20 number one New York Times bestsellers, and they still get that imposter syndrome with every book. Like, this is the one where everyone's going to know I'm a fraud and this my career is over, right? Like, yeah. So I mean, you've had probably over 100 roles, right? I mean, probably far more than that, but I mean, huge, huge roles. And so you're still getting, do you still get that imposter syndrome from time to time?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Oh, well, So Neil Simon makes the ill-conceived decision to update The Odd Couple, and he calls it Felix and Oscar, and they produce it at the Geffen Theater with Joe Regalbuto and John Larroquette starring in the lead roles. And I got cast as Vinny, one of the buddies. And they're taking that very period, you know, American male 1960s sensibility, and they're going to put it in the 1990s. And I came up, because you have to cut to the chase, I came up with a very strong character voice and dialect to make me different than the other five pals who all, right? And they cast me, Gil Cates and Peter Bonners, who was directing. They hired me, and the first day of rehearsal, there's Neil while we're doing a read-through. Now, I go, okay, I got the job. Now we're going to come back to zero. I'm going to listen to my other actors. We're going to read the play. We're going to hear it all. And I dumped all of my result-oriented choices that I made in my audition and just read the role. And at the lunch break, Peter Bonners comes to me and he goes, Craig, I don't know how to tell you this, but Neil thinks you're wrong for the role. He goes, I know what you're doing. You're just, that we're in rehearsal and we all know what you're capable of because you audition with it and we all sounds great. But Neil thinks that you don't have the thing. And he wants to fire you. What? So he goes, so here's what we're going to do. Tomorrow, first thing, we're going to do another table read. And would you just give us the performance that you gave us in the audition just to take care of Neil's concerns? And then we'll go back to our rehearsal process. And I left that first day of rehearsal. I was going, wow, Neil Simon wants to fire me. Wait, should I tell him that he offered me a job when I was a reader for Brighton Beach Memoirs back when I was still a Juilliard student? And I said, no. Oh, is it payback? Is that what that is? So I didn't actually think of that in the moment. I thought about that after the fact, but I said, okay, yeah, right. I got to do a dog and pony show for Neil Simon, who for all of his years in this industry doesn't understand what is going on, but he also was not at my audition. He didn't see, and all my other buddies, the other actors really are the characters that they're playing, where I put on a persona with a dialect, and, you know, I sounded like this, not a New York, you know, not Vinny from New York, a dog that does it, and as an insecure. And Neil needed that. So I did it, and then we finished the reading, and Peter came to me and goes, you're good. You got a job. And it was like, but that was fascinating to have to see that and go, oh, yeah, okay. Wow, that, because it stung in a way. But then I was able to put it in the perspective that, oh, I see how he's thinking. I understand. And I really want this job. So, yeah, I'll jump through a few hoops. For my job security.
You're acting for your job. You're on the line. This is it. And I guess you do that when you audition, right? But this is different because you have the job and you're there. To what extent does like that pressure cooker affect your creativity? Because I know it does in writing and things when people are under deadline. It can be inhibiting in a lot of ways. Did it do that, or was it just so motivating that it lets you just like no holds barred, right? You just went out with the character.
It was a 24-hour experience, that conflict. And once it was resolved, it was gone. It evaporated. It was no longer, because even Neil, as he dealt with me, he had a respect. He goes, oh, you're a chameleon. You actually have the ability to embody other personas. And so I had a respect there. So it was not a prolonged experience. It you know, we fixed it early thanks to the wisdom of Peter Bonners and Gil Cates, who also understood what was going on and just said, okay, yeah, well, you know, we can't just tell Neil it's going to be fine. We have to show Neil.
Having Neil tell you you're a chameleon has to be a wonderful moment in your career.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the story that I was alluding to, I was a reader for the casting offices of Simon and Cumin when I was a Juilliard student to make money. And the Brighton Beach Memoirs and Biloxi Blues were all playing on Broadway. And I was reading for the auditions for the Broadway production and the national tours. And I was reading for the part of Wykowski for Brighton Beach Memoirs. Actually, I was reading several roles. But after a full day of auditions, Gene Sachs, director, and who was the company manager, and Neil, they were all there. They came up to the stage and said, Greg, would you consider, we'd like to offer you the role of Wykowski for the national tour, just because I was reading with other people. We were auditioning John Stamos. We were auditioning, you know, a bunch of other people, but I was just the guy who read with them. And they went, we'd like to offer you a job. And I went, and I was in my third year at Juilliard out of a 4-year program. And I was going, okay, validation. The validation number 572, right? These individuals, icons of the American theater, are saying, we want to hire you. And I went, okay, first, thanks. However, my parents are worried I'm never going to finish anything. And in a year, I'm going to have a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. And then I'll be completely available to work for you again. So I hope you'll understand. Thank you. I would love to be able to take it, but I need to finish my training at Juilliard because I know when I'm done, I'll have even greater tools to be successful. And they went, you bet. I don't know that anyone's ever turned us down for a job, but it worked out. But clearly, Neil kept it in the back of his head. Nobody says no to Neil Simon. I'm going to fire Jabara.
I don't know that I've ever heard of anyone doing that either. You get your break, right? You get this opportunity and you turn it down. I mean, if you had it to do over again, obviously it worked out, but would you advise someone to do that?
I would advise everyone to follow their own heart because several of us from Juilliard, including, never finished the program. They got job opportunities and left school and didn't finish and have great careers. So I think, you know, it's about everybody and their own thing. I had a couple of personal obligations to fulfill. So my folks knew that I was capable of finishing something.
So let's talk about directing. What you've acted in every way a human being can act over these decades. Did you always want to get into directing, or what was it that motivated this? Where does this come from?
I was never the actor who said, yeah, but I really want to direct. Never. Never. Because you have to understand, even though in TV and film, actors are spoiled. And not because we're all celebrities and divas. It's because actors are liabilities. And a show can't afford to have somebody sleep in and miss a call. If you lose a day of filming, it could be $100,000 down the toilet. So actors get cars to pick them up. They get fed. They have a trailer. They're accommodated so they can make the calendar of the workday because you can't afford to have an actor. And actors are idiots, just like everybody. They just want to protect themselves they want to make sure the day is successful, and especially where the obligations come from all the many actors that are involved in a particular show. So actors get spoiled, taken care of. I only have to worry about me when I work on Oppenheimer. I only had to worry about me on Blue Bloods. I only had to worry about, actually only had to worry about me. Well, Billy Elliot, it was a bigger familial experience, but directors, I watch them. I worked with the best of them. From Christopher Nolan to Jack O'Brien on Broadway to Stephen Daldry to Peter Yates, my very first film job, accomplished British film actor or film director. I see their work. I go, wow, that's a lot of responsibility. That's a lot of egos managed. That's a lot of train wrecks navigated. It's like, I like just worrying about my thing. I'm really happy here. I worked on a movie. Longtime friend, she's a Broadway investor, Kit Seidel. Her son is an accomplished storyteller, writes plays, and then started writing screenplays. Kit said, write a role for my friend, Greg Jabara. We shoot this movie in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. The director who directed that film had different ideas about how it should be when we showed up to film than what was on the page. And it scared It was a problem for all of us who really came from the theater and we're all getting together to do this movie. And we didn't really know how to manage this sort of creative differences because we didn't have the budget to just go, oh, okay, we have creative differences. We're going to start over. We couldn't afford that. Because I had been an actor for so long, I saw what was going on and did the choices that the director asked and then said, and I'd like to do one or two tries with the way as it's written on the page, please. So when the film was delivered, director's cut by the director, and they were let go, then the producers all tried to go back and rebuild the film as intended. Only my character was completely intact because I made a point of making sure all my scenes still had what the writer had intended initially. So when he wrote his next screenplay, they're interviewing directors, and about 2 weeks in, Kit emails me and she goes, I think you need to be directing this movie. And I've known her for over a decade. I've never talked about ever having any interest in directing. But she goes, just let me know if I'm out of my mind, but I think this is something you should be doing. And it came right as we came out of the actor strike and were told that we were in our final season of Blue Blood. So I knew that I was unemployed, and it was a gift. It was handed to me, and I was smart enough to go, okay. And then the success of that job was because our two producers, Julie Crosby and David Yaus, I got to collaborate with our DP, Sarah Brandis. She was the cinematographer on the first movie we all did together. I'm madly in love with her. We collaborated. We both really co-directed this film. She visually, me with the actors. And our producers said, okay, we're gonna meet the top 10 people for every department head because we're a $1.5 million budget film. They're not a big picture. So they're saying, we're gonna meet everybody who looks good on paper, and we're gonna find out who's the least toxic, who doesn't need to make this about them, who's capable of leaning in, because with a $1.5 million budget, when something goes south, we need everybody to come together, not people go, oh, I'm out of here, or no, that's unacceptable, right? And they did. Every single person, they said, okay, here's our choice. And so, because I had contractual final approval for every person hired. After the first two, I was just going, so on a Zoom, I go, so, I'm going to tell you, tomorrow you're going to get called and hired for this job. You're spectacular. Thank you so much. I didn't have to vet anybody. And the same thing was with our actors who I had final approval and to meet, even though we'd made offers. I had the most fun, and it was so easy because everybody was spectacular at their job, and everybody knew they had a voice and an opinion that I wanted to hear. So, well before our first day of shooting, all the possibilities were considered, and we were all in consensus and going toward the same goal when we started filming. And it really was, it was so easy. I laughed every day. I worked 4 hours sleep, and not because I couldn't sleep. That's all I was allowed. You know, I could sleep 4 hours, then I had to get to set. We had pre-production meetings, then we'd shoot for 8 to 10 hours, and then we'd have post to prep for the next day. I'd get 4 hours sleep. I was never happier. Never happier. A full month, absolute bliss. And you'll see it all on the screen on April 24th when Original Sound is in theaters nationwide.
Oh, I can't wait. And first off, congratulations. That's a really big deal.
Thank you.
From just talking to you through this, you have this infectious enthusiasm, but it reminds me, like, I worked with the military for many years, and you have this like inverted pyramid of leadership. And this is what you're really describing, right? Where the guy at the top is really at the bottom because his job is to make sure everybody else gets what they need to do their jobs. You know, and I'm getting that from you. Like, you sound like a mission driven person who's like, you're getting everyone excited about what they're doing. You're letting them feel free and safe to try things because you all have one goal. And like, there isn't a better kind of leader, in my opinion, than that.
And that's what I learned in my four decades of experience. There were the great leaders were the humans who connected with you on a personal level. Even though you were way down in the food chain, with me at Blue Bloods, I knew the name of our script supervisors, the script carriers who brought it from the printing room to the set. For me, I'm a people person. And our first day of filming Blue Bloods, I arrived maybe 45 minutes before my call time, and I'm standing about a block away, looking down the street in Williamsburg, where all the trucks are on the street loading into the recording studio where we're filming. And it's a beehive of activity. And I didn't have to tell anybody anything. Like, it was all happening without me having to direct traffic or anything. And I walked into one of the holding areas and started introducing myself to people. And I say, hi, I'm Greg. What's your name and what do you do? And they say, oh, I'm so the PA. What do you do? I go, I'm the director. And they go, like, what are you doing here? Am I being fired? It was like, it was such an anomaly. It was to have the director. But for me, that was so important. And it was intentional. It's like, yeah, we're all working toward the same goal. I want you calling me Greg. I want to know what you do. I'm going to be calling you by your first name. Something Jerry Lewis taught me when he joined the cast of Damn Yankees back in 1994 or 1995, he replaced Victor Garber in Damn Yankees on Broadway. He shows up at the Marquee Theater, says, just from everybody from the stage doorman to the janitor, hi, I'm Jerry. What's your name? Nice to meet you. Hi, I'm Jerry. What's your name? Day two, he walks in the door. He goes, hey, first name. hey, first name. And we all just went, that is amazing. And first of all, an amazing feat, but what a gift that he gave everyone to say, I see you, I know who you are, and that's how we're going to be working together. And it made an impression on me. And even though at 64, names are starting to slip when I want to recall them, but in the workplace, calling everybody by their name and is so important to me because I appreciated it when I got it.
For all these decades of working with all these sort of legends and on the stage or on the screen, you're putting all these tools into your kit, right? For eventually when you become a director, what were the things you saw that you were like, I would never do that, or that's something that just should never happen? What were the, were there anything that jumps out at you or things you're like, that will not be the type of director I'm going to be?
Am I having a knee-jerk reaction that I don't want to? I don't have to name names, but no, I'm not coming up with like anything. Style. Yeah, I've been pretty lucky. Not directors, no. Actors, yes. There have been some actors who, I'm a little supporting role in a big feature film, and we shoot all the stars' coverage, and then it's time to turn around and shoot me, and they get up and leave. And I'm reading the scene now with the director. And that was my first dose of that very early on. And I went, oh, that's a shame. Oh, he must have an important press event that he has to get to, right? and did it actually make my back go up? No. Did I get offended? No. I went, oh, he didn't have to do that. Because you know who doesn't do that? Tom Selleck. Tom Selleck is, even when we're on the phone and we've shot for an 8-hour day, if it's a phone conversation, he goes, I'm sticking around. I want to be there for you. Cause he's like, we created that scene together and I want to be there for you just like you were for me. And, so when that doesn't happen, that's a little bit of a disappointment, but not a surprise sometimes.
Does that affect the performance? Like, does it help to have like the star with you going through reading the lines? Does it keep like that energy or that magic that you guys are creating together?
Sure, it does. Yeah. And, you know, what I can remember, the tuxedo shop scene in and Out with Kevin Klein, Tom Selleck, Pat Garner, and myself. And for us to, and Frank Oz directing, there's a shot where for them to get my coverage, none of them could actually be standing where they normally are. They had to cheat all of their locations closer to the lens so it looked good for this particular angle. So they're all literally standing over each other just to be able to be in my sight line so that I can actually deliver the lines to them. Because they could have said, hey, Greg, act your scene. We're going to put an X right here. And just say your lines to the X, which I do all the time and have learned to do quite well. I would challenge anyone to be able to know, oh, I could tell you're acting to a mark on the wall and not really a person. But, you know, those guys just said, yeah, we'll contort. We'll do whatever it takes to support you, because that's what I think real artists do in that world is they don't make their own needs a priority. They're about the team.
I love that. I love the fact that you all come together to create something really special. Was there something when you directed this movie that surprised you? Something with all this experience you have, when you're the guy doing it, was there something, some unique obstacle or challenge that you hadn't anticipated?
Yeah. So the first day, of course, I'm going, look at this thing. It runs by itself. And then literally that day, after I met everybody, and then somebody had to go, oh, we heard you're on set, Mr. Jabara. We'd like you up on the set. So, and then I get escorted to my chair and I'm handed headphones and I'm handed a monitor. And then my first AD, she's running the whole show. She's amazing, by the way. She really, a first AD is key for a directing job. But all of that set. So we're shooting on a sound stage, two scenes. It's our hero. One of our heroes, she's, uh, She and her manager, it's Laura Morano and Eric Stoltz, are arriving at a photo studio in L.A. because she, the pop star, is having a photo shoot for an album cover. And Sarah Brandis, the DP, and I planned to do this big single push from the far end of the soundstage where the photo shoot's happening and end with a screamer right on, you know, right on Ryan, Laura Morano's face. And it involved 60 background actors, all who had props and things, you know, lighting cues, blah, blah, blah. So, and then that scene's followed by a scene in the makeup, in a dressing room with lots of mirrors and makeup lights, where the manager, Eric Stoltz, and Laura Morano as Ryan have a very difficult conversation. Well, we shot them out of sequence. We shot the dressing room scene first with a lot of mirrors, which meant we were hiding the camera behind actors and a few little conveniently located curtains. And it took longer, like an hour and a half to 2 hours longer than we thought. Then we got to go shoot this massive one and done with 60 extras, and we haven't even staged it yet. So Sarah's busy choreographing all the tech stuff to get it set up, and I'm choreographing all the background actors with my first AD. And then we get to a moment where Sarah and I realize, wait, she says, no, I'm going to have the director come in from over there. And I go, oh, but we agreed it was going to be over. She goes, and we stopped because we realized we'd been staging to start the scene from two completely different places. And we're talking lighting, and I had no actors over there. She was just doing it all tech. And then at the same moment, Laura Morano walks up and goes, hey, I'm in the wrong makeup for this scene. And we're going, what? She goes, yeah, if we're out of sequence, I go, okay, well, that was in the schedule. She goes, yeah, but I can't do this with this. We're going to need like an hour to, you know, to redo her makeup. And I'm going, and the DP and I and the two producers who now were, you know, Julie Crosby and David Dallas are literally arms crossed over the shoulder of our DP that I can see at the far wall, you know, doing this. And our DP and our my first AD is also going, whoo, man, they're up my personal stuff. They really, we got to get going. And we're going, so we have two crises, right? The state, we're completely staging differently, and Laura doesn't have the right makeup. Laura goes, how about I just come into the scene with my sunglasses on? And she goes, and I'll make sure that when the camera gets close, I'm not square to the lens, so there's no reflection. And we all went, good fix, way to go. Then, now we're talking, everybody on the film is still in this room at this time. Also, my first AD, she had to grab everybody's collars because people were starting to get a little heated. And she went, we're not doing that. No one's yelling. It's not going to, that's not happening. We're going to figure this thing out. And then, so Laura had her fix. They went away. Sarah and I are looking at each other. We go, okay, give us 5 minutes. And Sarah and I are standing in the center of the room. And I go, so what were you seeing? And she goes, well, I thought we could do it this way. And I'm going, right. And you've already lit it for that. So all I have to do is re-choreograph some background people. Okay. All right. Let's do it your way. And then we went and we did it. And then we got seven complete takes. All, you know, it's a one shot, big 50 foot long, maybe 75 feet long dolly shot. Right. And with 60 background extras, and we got it. We did it seven times and two of them were usable. And we got to choose the best of the two. And Sarah and I, still to this day, we meet for lunch, whatever, we go, any other egos in that moment, that would have been screaming, a big caca mess, and the production would have come to a screeching halt. But we were so proud that we went, oh, wow. Because it's the only time anything like that ever happened on the entire project. And all the people did exactly what we needed them to do. They had the personality to go, okay, how do we fix it? And we did. And
so how much of that do you foster, like when you're staffing a project versus the atmosphere that you're creating when you come into this? Like, is it a little of both? Or is it like, did you just have the right people in there? Or did you just make it so everybody was so engaged to make this thing work?
I will credit our two producers, Julie and David Yost, Julie Crosby, because they took the time to really vet the individuals and go, oh, this is the person who is like us. So this is the person we, and so that was done. There were a few people who slipped through the cracks. There were a few people who had some dark energy, and our producers, I was never aware. I didn't personally interact with some of these individuals. It was happening maybe, you know, one step away from me, but it was all taken care of. It was like, hey, we see you. We know you're unhappy because you're bringing your misery to work. You're free to go if you'd like to, or we need you to leave your garbage at home. And our producers manage that. So I was just like, and I learned that on the first film we all did in Truth or Consequences, there was stuff that went down. I, as an actor, had no idea, but that's what you want, right? You want the producers who are really managing all the insanity and nuts and bolts. And then so all the creative can just, you know, throw their merry dust or their fairy dust in and make their magic.
It's amazing how many people it takes to create art like this. How many people in total did you have on this project?
There were 200 people employed by this job, and there were over 200 people employed by Blue Bloods as well. And our film is a very low budget film. There would be a lot more people, you know, a much bigger post production team. A much deeper production assistant team. We were skeleton bare bones, but it was still, you know, a full month of work for a lot of people and union work, which was great.
Is this directing now? Is this something going forward? Is this what you want to keep doing, or do you want to do a little of everything? What's in the immediate future for you?
So I still haven't had a new job since Blue Bloods ended 2 years ago. I have not, and I've been auditioning my butt off. I do voiceover auditions, 5 to 20 a week. I do 5 to 10 theater or film or TV auditions a month. And I'm self-taping, putting myself out there. Nothing's hitting, nothing. So I would love for this, you know, you can't, I know how to promote myself as an actor. As a director, I think it's probably the same thing, but I'm learning to become a part of that network of people. But you need a product. People are going to see the movie and go, oh, that's a good movie. Who directed that? They did that for how much? Oh, we want him to work for us because that looks like a $10 million, $15 million film. And he did it for 1.5. And how'd you get those people? Oh, okay. Then, yeah. So I'm hoping that when this film comes out, the industry goes, oh yeah, because that is certainly how I get work. It's somebody sees my work and goes, oh, let's hire him. And that happens a lot.
With your skill level, your enthusiasm, and just in the way you approach this work, I have no doubt you're going to land something big in the very near future. Like, I have no doubt. I would bet everything on that.
Thank you, Jeff. I hope you're right. That'd be a wonderful gift.
Well, so where should people go to find you? Do you have a website?
Yes. So GregoryJabara.com is my website. It has everything. It has everything. Everything you need to know. And I just updated it myself. I don't have the budget for assistance. I do it all myself. If you email me at my website, it comes directly to me. I vet all the communications. And then Original Sound, which is coming out April 24th, originalsoundfilm.com. They have a search engine. So you can go in, give them your zip code. It'll tell you where the theater is nearest you to see our movie when it opens on April 24th. But if there are any Michiganders listening, the film's playing only at the Livonia 20, AMC Livonia 20 in Michigan. And I'm going to go home. It opens the 24th. On the 28th, at the I'm doing a live talk back for at the Inspire Theater at the Westland Center for the Arts, just to celebrate this new experience with my hometown. And I'm very excited for that opportunity as well.
Oh my God, that sounds like so much fun. Listen, I wish you the success with this movie. I'm excited. I will go see it. And I hope all of our viewers go out and so see it and support you as well.
Thank you, Jeff. And even though I know you know, I don't read, but I'm going to read something you wrote, and I'm going to come have dinner at your restaurant.
I wish you would. We'd love to have you here. And any way we can support you, just let us know.
Thank
Greg,
you.
Thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you, Jeff. Same to you.